Welcome to my Icon podcast. I'm Tom Kelleher, co-founder of Icon Solutions, and I'm alongside
Darren Caporn, also co-founder of Icon Solutions. Not allowed to call it my podcast line, just in case you're wondering why it's Tom's podcast. But I'm really looking forward to this because every time I see you, we're just passing in the corridors of some conference in some distant place. And so to get an hour of your time where you're not running off to see somebody and actually find out a little bit more about you is splendid. So over to you, Tom, to delve in.
I don't think you've got an hour. It's just half an hour, mate.
No, we'll have an hour. We'll just edit out all the nonsense that you talk and get it down in about 5 minutes.
You're overcooking it there.
On you go.
This podcast is entirely conceived for us to spend more time talking to interesting people in the world of payments. And we're delighted to be joined by Lauren Jones. Good morning, Lauren.
Morning, Tom, Darren. Fantastic to be here.
Where are you today?
I'm actually, for the first time in a while, at home in Brussels, sunny Brussels, Belgium, today.
Wow. I was going to say, you've been all over the place. You've been in Zimbabwe recently. What brought you there?
I was in Zimbabwe. That was actually personal travel. I've just got back from Tajikistan for a financial inclusion conference, which was fantastic and amazing to see those parts of the world and what they're doing in payments.
So, Lauren, you're currently the chair of the ISO group focused on security and financial services, founder and CEO of Goodfin, a global payments and fintech consultancy, a member of the Open Banking Advisory Board. You've worked at Huawei, Consensus, and have been the head of standards at Pay.UK. But before we get into the ever-changing world of payments, I wanted to start at the beginning to learn a little bit more about you, where you grew up, and the interests of a young Lauren. Can you tell us a little bit about your early years?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an unusual question when you have a professional podcast, but absolutely. I mean, I must admit, I had a very good start in life. I grew up in leafy southwest London and then moved out to Surrey, so not actually far from where your offices are based.
Just
down the road. So a really great part of the world. And went to a fantastic school. I was taught by nuns, so not quite the Sister Act movie, but not far off.
That's the one in Cobham, is it?
The one in Cobham, yeah, the one in Surrey. So Notre Dame, it's part of the kind of convent school system out of Paris. I think there's about 100 schools around the world. So, you know, extremely privileged from an educational point of view. My home life was quite challenging, so I threw myself, I think, into reading and academics and I was kind of reasonably, you know, well off at school in that respect. So I quite liked school. Yeah. Not that I was a nerd, but, you know, I was decently academic, should I say. And I had a fantastic politics teacher when I was doing my kind of A-levels. So for those of you not in the British school system listening, you know, the kind of 16 to 18 exams, years 16 to 18. And that really kind of, I was already super interested in current affairs, but got me really interested in kind of political science, political theory. So went off to study political science at Nottingham. I was extremely lucky. My father worked in the film industry, so I traveled a huge amount as a kid. And I don't think that bug has ever left me.
So, yeah, you went to Nottingham, yeah, with the political science angle. So did you have ambitions of becoming a councillor, a member of parliament? I mean, God knows we've needed public servants with a moral compass over the last 10 years.
Well, I hope I do have a moral compass, but I did actually. And perhaps I still do. And there is form because Theresa May used to work for APAX, which obviously is the predecessor to Pay.UK before Payments UK and Payments Council before that. So she was, I believe, head of European affairs. So there is a precedence.
Yeah, so you never Rachel know. Reeves worked for HBOS, so maybe I can get into politics soon as well.
There is form. I mean, it's a tough gig, isn't it? It's a tough gig. But I think I would enjoy it. You never say never. Never say never.
And so how did your career develop then and what drew you into the world of payments?
It was totally unforeseen. I mean, look, we all love what we do. I think, you know, the one thing I love about this industry is that most of us are pretty passionate and for whatever reason stick around for many, many years within it. But, you know, it wasn't my childhood dream to to work in the payments industry. But I had intended to go kind of into one of the government grad schemes, you know, perhaps get into the Foreign Office. But unfortunately for me, I graduated in 2008. So obviously the financial crash. There were, and when I say it's hard to kind of look back on that now, but there was zero, like literally zero jobs They were like nothing. It was
We were
like
hiring, weren't we?
slim pickings.
I can't remember when I graduated. We were just doing decimalisation, Tom. So,
No. I mean, when we set up Icon in 2009. Shame we didn't cross paths.
it was a brutal time. And so I was kind of, I guess, licking my wounds a little bit in the fact that I couldn't get those grad schemes weren't open. Even some of the big bank grad schemes weren't opening and functioning then. But I really, really wanted to work in policy and policy development. So after a very brief stint, and don't judge me too harshly for it, in pharmaceuticals, I found there was a job being offered what was then Payments Council, obviously the million different governance changes of the payments industry in the UK, in the standards team. And I was like, what is this standards, nonsense? But kind of saw it as a way to get into, what was essentially quite a policy-related organisation at the time. And the rest is history. I kind of got hooked. I got hooked on it. So yeah, kind of worked my way up within Payments Council then. Obviously it became Payments UK, and obviously now it's Pay.UK. And yeah, I've loved it. I kind of toyed over the years of kind of leaving payments, but it's like a honeypot. You can't escape.
It touches everything.
It does.
Yeah, I think when we were first working together on UK faster payments back in sort of 2005, I think our view very much was, instant is the new normal, and payments has just got to get faster and faster in every aspect of life. So, kind of thought it was a pretty good place to operate going forward.
Yeah, and I think, looking back then, and obviously I was young then, more or less fresh out of university. I was surrounded by some fantastic people in Payments Council that had been around for a long time. Really smart, really interested in what they were doing. Darren's face. But it was still a quiet kind of backwater. Everyone was like, oh, why don't you get into capital markets or the more kind of faster paced, interesting side, or quote unquote interesting side of financial services. But now it's like everyone's itching to get into it. It's the place to be. It's the cool kid on the block. And I wouldn't have thought that back when I was starting out.
No, the people in payments were sort of beards and sandals in the corner of
Yeah.
an IT room, but now they're the rock stars of the tech world with in payments.
And that kind of knowledge is like, and I think that's something we need to challenge ourselves on as an industry, is like keeping that some of that knowledge alive as people start to retire or, move on to other things, is, how we harness some of that really fantastic knowledge that's within the guys that have been around, since some of the stuff was created.
You're quite the adventurer, and as you said, you're always on the move. And if you, I'm sure you remember, back in sort of between 2017 and 2020, you were the global payments ambassador for Icon. So that took you far and wide. It'd be interesting to hear some of the stories of your adventures. And I think you were l talking to different payments organizations in different countries.
Yeah, so I think it was 2017. I'd been working for Payments UK for quite some time, and kind of felt like I needed a break. And what was 1 year sabbatical turned into, 3 years or more or less 3 years. I mean, look, it was a fantastic experience, both personally and professionally. I mean, I think it's made me better at my job and richer knowledge of what is going on and how other markets and other cultures operate within payments. We get quite fixated on some of the more developed markets like the UK or the US or Europe. But knowing what's going on in some of these, smaller markets that have, similar but much more in-depth challenges that we take for granted in terms of how we operate. So I think professionally, it made me m a much better payments professional and financial services professional. And I like to still work with emerging economies through because of that experience. But yeah, personally, it was a crazy time. 3 years. I mean, my friends that was, kind of came with me traveling to various different places. I remember getting kind of dengue fever in Guatemala in like a tiny, tiny little hamlet where there was, I think like three houses, and not being able to move and not being able to travel and get out of this village and kind of being unconscious for about 3 weeks. Lost in the Brazilian jungle, bribes at borders. It probably would make for a fantastic documentary or soap opera. Like some of my friends and colleagues call me Indiana Jones, not Lauren Jones. So, but it stays with me. And like I say, like from a payments point of view, I feel quite confident talking about what's going on in lots of different countries where I think actually, like I say, particularly people from the UK and the US, they get very fixated on what's happening there. And I think there's a much wider world out there that we could also learn from.
I think we should have been paying you a little bit more as our global ambassador, going through that sort of trauma.
Yeah, it's all but makes for good stories, you know.
Just on the promise of sort of changes in the in banking and payments, particularly around open banking. Do you think it's delivered for consumers in the UK and businesses?
It's really important to look at open banking through like a realistic lens. I think it's a fundamentally different way of, you know, accessing, monetizing, distributing financial services, right? Whereas, you know, previous, you know, projects or initiatives that, or innovation initiatives that we do as industry typically revolves around infrastructure, right? We just plant a bit of infrastructure in the middle, and then like companies can do some stuff around the outside, and away we go. But this is kind of more philosophical than that, and I think it takes time. I think from the payment side, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of the HMRC, you know, UK Government Tax Office figures around how many people pay with open banking now. I think that's really starting to take hold. And I think the kind of disruption point of view for open banking payments is significantly easier to measure, right? Because you can go to a checkout, you know, on an e-commerce site and pay with Pay by Bank, and it's much easier to see the direct benefits to that. I think when it comes to data, it's a slower pace of change, I think, particularly in the UK. You know, open banking data, and you know, I'm quite honest about this, to be honest, is quite limited in its scope. We're talking about transactional account data, payment account data. There's not that much you can actually really do with that. You need to have access to a customer's wider financial portfolio, you know, whether it's mortgages, you know, insurance products, whatever else they're potentially engaged with. We don't have that in the UK. So I think we're somewhat limited in terms of what we can offer. That being said, I think there's quite a number of, you know, cool things that are coming out, particularly around, you know, credit, thin file credit customers that are supporting, you know, their existing Experian data with, you know, real-time account data, because they're, you know, paying their rent back every month, they're paying their phone bill every month, you know, they're good for the money, but that data isn't taken into consideration when you think of, you know, your traditional credit bureau stuff. So there is some interesting stuff happening, but it's still having to be complemented by other ways of accessing that data, like screen scraping, because open finance is not on the agenda in the UK yet. We're a little bit behind, I think.
You mentioned sort of Pay by Bank there as a facility that's been sort of more widely used. That's putting more pressure on the big card providers, I would imagine Mastercard and Visa and so on, and others. Do you see that sort of continuing to be a trend and sort of more direct access, being the standard going forward?
Definitely on the e-commerce side, I think the open banking user journey for physical retail is not there yet. You know, I've seen some of the user journeys for that in store, and I think, you know, it can't possibly rival contactless payments yet. E-commerce, absolutely. I mean, me personally, when I have an opportunity to use Pay by Bank, and it's not because I'm just like an open banking nerd, it genuinely is a better user experience. Like, I love it. So, you know, when I pay HMRC, I will use that, and when there's other opportunities to use it, I will. So I think, you know, the user experience plus the reduced cost for the merchant for processing those payments is like a perfect marriage, and why wouldn't you use it? And you know, some of the large airlines like Emirates in Europe now are incentivizing customers to use Pay by Bank through, like, you know, increased loyalty points and stuff like that, because they've been squeezed so hard by the card schemes. So if you go on Emirates and want to buy an Emirates flight ticket, you know, they're actively incentivizing you to use Pay by Bank because it's in their interests. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that. And I think the industrialized use cases like the airline industry or, you know, government payments are what's going to move the dial, not kind of small, low value retail payments. But I think we're getting there.
So that's a sort of Bitcoin, if you want. That's there's a 138 countries exploring sort of those CBDCs, but the US has gone on to sort of ban the digital dollar, and instead they're going for a stable coin pegged to the US dollar. What do you think that means to the sort of global financial system?
I mean, I think the you know, and I don't want this to turn into a political podcast, but some of the US administration's decisions, and I think also the rationale for the decisions is quite interesting, where, you know, if you look at some of the rhetoric and wording he's used around banning CBDCs, it's all around sovereignty, national sovereignty. We want to ban CBDCs because they're a threat to national sovereignty, which is kind of strange when you look at them doubling down on crypto, which is, I would say, more of a threat to national sovereignty than CBDC. So I think some of the kind of rationale for the decisions is, I would say, challenged. I mean, I think it's going to be interesting for the fintech market in terms of how they respond, right? Because you've got this kind of like volatility in the markets, which isn't great for investment. But on the flip side of that, you've got a fairly lax regulatory environment, which also is great for fintech in some ways. So you've kind of got these two things that are kind of seemingly working against each other, but would actually perhaps harvest quite an interesting fintech environment. I think with obviously with what's going on with some of the tariffs, I think it's perhaps a little bit too early to tell in terms of what some of the downstream effects are going to be. But I find it, quite interesting. Like I say, some of the rationale behind the decision making, and there are lots of other podcasts that talk about some of the economics behind it and whether they're good, bad, indifferent.
Yeah, indeed. And when you've also got the sort of Consumer Financial Protection Bureau being dismantled as well, it's going to leave a lot of uncertainty and a lack of knowledge for the consumer out there on what's best. There's opportunities for them to make mistakes, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at a time when, the market is becoming ripe for poor practices. And you've got new innovations coming in as well, on top of already the existing, innovations and infrastructures that exist, not just in the US, but internationally, things like AI and, some of the algorithms around that. Consumers need protecting, right? Either that's via a separate entity, like what the CFPB were doing in the US, or through central government directly. And both large and small countries have these, even within some very small emerging economies, within central banks, they have fairly strong consumer protection teams. So I think the concept of consumer protection being this political football does a huge disservice to consumers themselves and businesses that are trying to instill good practices, right? And financial crises, future financial crises are something we should be actively avoiding and not trying to, almost deliberately create conditions in which they can arise. So I think that, the downsizing or, readjustment to the CFPB, could potentially lead to the erosion of trust in financial services, and I don't think that's good for either consumers or the industry.
I think we found when we were probably back in 2012, Tom and I took a trip to New York to an ISO conference. And the view seemed to be, prevailing view of the US banks was that they didn't want regulation and that they could not see the upside of it. Now, that was only the cohort that were in the room. But fundamentally, without it, obviously, lax regulation can be good for fintechs. But unless you get inertia behind some of these ideas, then it's very difficult to get ubiquity on anything that is going to move the dial in terms of giving better customer experiences. So it's kind of refreshing that they've finally went and started doing ISO initiatives. But it was really quite difficult for anybody to see the upside. And it's not just in the US. I can remember being at in a European conference just after UK Faster Payments had launched, and Europe were beginning to talk about it. And one of the attendees suggested they didn't need instant payments because they had checkbooks.
Bless.
This is an uphill struggle.
I think it's difficult, much like I try and check myself as a professional looking, obviously I've grown up, if you like, professionally in the UK, for us to look at what else is going on in the world and how other cultures approach, you want to get to the same outcome but by different means. I think the US is exactly that. Like, when we come from I definitely living in the EU now, come from an environment that is extremely, some could argue overregulated, and the US traditionally goes the other way, very limited regulation or and perhaps only some guardrails around the outside. I think, when you look at open banking, they've let that go largely unregulated for the last 20, 25 years. And actually a lot of fantastic innovation has come out in that time in the absence of regulation. Now the CFPB is like, okay, well, actually it's gone a bit far now. We want to put some guardrails in place. We want to make sure consumers are protected. We want to make sure their data is protected. And I think that's, typically how the US goes about it. And I think with the absence of the CFPB and, some of the reduction in powers of other, federal officers around financial services, who's going to step in when regulation is necessary? When it's got so far that, the guardrails, quote unquote, do need to be put in place. And I think that's my biggest fear.
Yeah, it happened before, didn't it, in 2008? So yeah, these things have
Exactly.
a habit of repeating themselves. But speaking of inertia, which Darren mentioned earlier, the journey to deliver the National Payments Vision or the NPA in the UK, I mean, It's been a long old journey, hasn't
Oh, it
it?
has.
And so, is there any end in sight, do you think? And what will we see in the short term?
I mean, look, Tom, I'm a bit long in the tooth. I don't think anyone in
Please.
the UK has been on this issue. Look, we had world-class payments. That was back in my day when I was at Payments UK then. So that must have been, what, 2014, 2013? So we're well over a decade into this conversation. Then it was the Payment Strategy Forum. Then it was new payments architecture. Now it's the
New
National
payments
Payments
vision.
Vision. Plus, there's been multiple governance changes in that time. You know, Payments Council, Payments UK, Pay.UK. Now PSR's going, and it's going to be absorbed into the FCA. So, you know, like I think I'd be forgiven for being a little bit sceptical. I think there's a lot of rearranging the deck chairs. I'm not saying the Titanic is sinking, but I think there's, you know, a lot creaking. You know, we've had some, you know, relatively high profile faster payments incidences recently. So I think we need to take a long, hard look at ourselves around having another committee that we talk about a lot of nice things and get nothing done. I think that the time is ripe for change. We need to invest in our infrastructure, but we also need to invest in things that actually make significant difference. And I think, you know, this is where, like, living in Belgium, you know, I've seen firsthand what small incremental change can do. Now, Belgium is not considered a particularly innovative payments market. It's very small, not a huge number of banks here. But they have, you know, small things like a QR code for P2P payments. I don't need to know your account details. I don't need to know your IBAN. I can just generate a QR code and request you to pay me or I pay you. That was, like, mind-blowing to me as a Brit. Like, how do we not have these things in the UK? And, you know, they're relatively easy to deliver, you know, but actually would have significant downstream benefits to consumers. I'm not saying we're going to go and pay by QR code in store because we're, you know, very card-based economy. But in terms of P2P payments, it's genuinely life-changing for me as a consumer. But we don't invest in that, you know, those type of small-scale changes. I'm a big advocate of open banking, as you know, and I've spent a lot of years working in that field. I think, you know, a lot of the way the vision reads is pinning our hopes on open banking as this kind of savior. I think it's one dimension of a much, you know, what I hope would be a much richer, broader payments portfolio that the UK can offer for consumers, whether that business or retail. So I think it misses some of the core elements for me. I think there's lots to be proud of in the UK. You know, we tend to be good at infrastructure, but I think there's a lot of other things that we can be focused on and should be focused on to make some small incremental changes. And I think, you know, focusing on things like open banking is not the full picture. Let's put it that way.
So I'm going to switch tack a little bit. You've spoken on many panels about the experience of women in payments and women in technology. What would you like people to understand about women in payments?
I think one of my biggest, I would say, issues, but also things I talk about on panels when I'm discussing this issue is that women are multifaceted. And there's kind of women in payments. I'm not entirely sure what that means. You know, there's women in policy making, there's women in technology, there's women in standards, which, you know, area that I came from, which is still exceptionally male dominated. You know, I'm more or less the only woman in the room, you know, most of the time. So I think, you know, it's not particularly nuanced. I think these are really important discussions, and we should be having them. And I think, you know, the industry has come quite a long way since I started, but we have quite a long way to go. And I also think we do ourselves a disservice as an industry by just discussing women as a kind of diversity topic. You know, we don't talk about religion or race or getting people from different socioeconomic backgrounds into the industry, and it's very one-dimensional in a way. And I think, like I say, they're really important discussions to have. And I think there's lots of difference between, you know, some of the younger people and the younger women in the industry's experience versus some of the older generations, and that doesn't often come out in some of the dialogue. So I would like to see it over the next few years get a bit deeper and richer in the nuance around, you know, women in the industry in general, but also the kind of much bigger diversity discussions that we should be having.
Yeah, totally. And I'm sure with that sort of approach, you'll get more people coming into women in payments, or from other backgrounds and so on into technology. But who inspired you to sort of get involved? How did you sort of get involved in the organization?
I've actually been extremely fortunate to have quite a number of, like, fantastic female role models within the industry. And, you know, they're such fantastic women that kind of almost sit behind the scenes in a way. You know, they're not CEO of Citibank or whatever. But they're doing some fantastic work in the background. One of which is Carla McKenna, who used to work for Citi and now works for the Global LEI Foundation, such a wonderful woman in terms of, you know, so confident in her skills, so confident in her abilities, you know, and is quite happy to bring other women up. There's many, many I could mention. Sadly, I've had, you know, the opposite experience as well, where you've had, you know, particularly women of a certain generation that don't like to see younger women succeed. And I think that is, you know, fundamentally still a problem. I think we talk about this quite a lot on panels, and I think some people think it's a myth. It absolutely isn't a myth. And the amount of young women that you will speak to, I think, have had similar experiences across the years. So I think we have a way to go. But I have been, yeah, extremely, extremely fortunate to have some fantastic women. And I think we should do more about singing their praises.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I guess it's a challenging time, and it's with what's going on around the world, you know, women in payments, LGBTQ, other organisations, with the sort of dismantling, if you like, of or the abandoning D&I around the world, that's going to put even more pressure on it. And I know this is close to your heart.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm part of the LGBTQ community. I mean, the industry does absolutely nothing. You know, it's relatively silent. When you look at other industries, particularly media, even, you know, the legal profession, there's a lot more activity in that space. You know, I'm lucky enough to have travelled a lot personally as well as professionally. So, but I know that if I hadn't done that, there isn't a lot of support in the industry when I travel to know where it's safe for me to go, where, you know, providing some advice. You know, does my organisation support me as an LGBTQ community member when I'm traveling to certain countries, you know? So when I say, and I think, you know, a lot of people would potentially criticize me for saying, oh, you know, it's not only about women, but I think, like I say, we're doing ourselves a disservice as an industry not to have stronger support to these other, like you say, inclusivity initiatives. LGBT being one, you know, race and religion, you know, there's lots of geopolitical issues going on in the world at the moment. And by just, you know, kind of focusing on women, like I said, I think we're losing a lot of that richness.
So I was at a conference recently where young women and girls were being encouraged to get into engineering and computer science by some of the biggest brands out there on the high street, you know, international organisations as well. And what struck me is that there's a lot of change in technology, particularly around AI. There's a continuous drive to source capability from the low-cost centres around the world. So in a, you know, a country like the UK, what advice would you give to sort of young, not just young women and girls, but also young men and young boys looking at technology and deciding whether that's the career for them?
It's an interesting one, the offshoring thing. But I think that the one thing I would say is that even with AI, you know, technology still has a human dimension to it. You know, ultimately, especially in our industry, a lot of the time you're trying to get things in, well, the retail banking and payments part of the industry, you're still trying to get things in the hands of consumers that then have to use that technology in some way, shape or form. And so I think understanding what that technology is being used for and understanding that human dimension will allow you to not only just become better at your job, but also have a unique skill set. You're not just sitting behind a screen coding, which obviously has its place. But what's the real life implications of that technology that you're trying to implement? And I think there will, for some time, still be quite a significant crossover between AI and humans. Like, it's not going to go off and do its own thing, you know, immediately. We're still a way off from that. So I think understanding that, and, you know, I've spent, as I know you two have, many years with techies. And
God love
they're
them.
fantastic at what they do. But I think that kind of, there's a unique skill between techies that can, you know, talk human language. And I think that's the bit that I would kind of say, like, you know, can hone in on that and nurture that, and you will be a sought after professional.
You're passionate about payments and its transformative effect on today's society. What do you believe has been the greatest benefit to ordinary people?
Well, this is an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I think, and it depends which country you're kind of talking about, what kind of types of countries you're talking about. When you're talking about kind of emerging economies, and at this conference I was at last week, the kind of drive towards, you know, digitization and you know, technology has actually really increased, like, financial literacy. And I think it's really hard in the UK to kind of ascertain what that really means, because whilst yes, we'd all like to have a better understanding of our finances, we still have access to really good banking apps. Like, there's very few that don't have access to a bank account, although there are some in the UK under particular circumstances. But in those kind of markets, like, the impact of that change is significant. Like, it's really significant, that kind of financial literacy aspect, and the use of mobile money and those types of things have been, I think, has been completely changed dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. In the UK or more developed, it's the variety of ways in which we can pay. Like, I literally, sometimes it blows my mind, and I'm like, I go to a checkout, e-commerce store, I'm like, it actually bamboozles me how much choice we have. And in one hand, you can say that's a negative, but I think that is also positive, because we have such a diverse range of people in the UK under different circumstances, that the speed, the accessibility of the way in which we can pay, we take for granted dramatically. And I think that's only going to get better. And with things like open banking and access to data that can complement that, it's only going to get better and better.
I was in a garden centre at the weekend where one of the checkouts was entirely blocked because the guy in the store was trying to explain Klarna to one of the customers. So at that point, I thought all of this diversity is not good. Just give him some cash, will you, and move on.
Cash.
You still carry cash?
Yes, yeah. It's almost
Cash.
like I
When I
don't
see
like
cash, I
payments.
actually feel like I'm in an alternate universe now.
Yeah.
I just never use it.
I had to send somebody a check the other day. It took me 20 minutes to get a postal order out of the post office because they had no idea how to do it.
You said two things in that sentence, Darren: check and postal
I
order.
know. Well, there was two options. Nobody had a checkbook, and I won't tell you that I was sending money to the government, but it was DVLA. And literally, the woman had to go and find her notebook where she'd written down the last time that she'd had to do a postal order. Another 20 minutes, I won't get back, Tom.
That's very true.
This is a really interesting point, because I think we talk a lot in the UK about, we need to keep checks for, certain segments of society, and we need to keep cash. Cash, I understand, obviously, but there is absolutely no, well, at least not that I've seen, genuine drive to educate on digital services. It's all like, okay, well, the lowest common denominator wins out, and therefore we will continue to propagate checks, and we'll continue to propagate postal orders, for example, where there is such a lack of an education agenda about how to bring in people into the kind of digital ecosystem and make them understand about how these things work and feel safe and trusted in using them. We just don't bother. It's too hard. It's in the too hard bucket.
Well, I wish
Whereas
someone
actually,
had
I think
told
we
that
should be
bloke at the garden
educating.
centre that, because he was definitely trying to educate and he was holding up my planting of my roses.
I'm not sure he's the right fellow.
So I was just the other day, I gave my daughter 20 quid in cash and
Oh my
she sort
gosh,
of
she was
looked at it and just
devastated.
went,
What a birthday that was.
what am I going to do with that? It's like, I can't use it. And she's quite right, because there's some places she'll go to and they just won't accept cash. It's
Won't
just
accept
card
it.
only, so digital transfer was made immediately.
Yeah, I think that's the way. I mean, when I speak to my young, and I wouldn't put myself in the particularly old camp, but much younger relatives who are like 17 and 18, they're the same. They have no concept of cash and checks. They want digital transfers, and they're buying stuff on Snapchat and all this kind of stuff. And it's a different world.
Absolutely.
Got to get with it, Darren.
Yeah, I know. Leave it with me.
Just buy online. You don't need to go to the garden centre.
I think I've used their last postal order at the local post office. It had a picture of King Alfred on it, I think. So,
Lauren,
That's...
what are you up to now? What's this year hold for you?
So I'm quite excited about it, freelancing for some time. Like, I kind of miss the diversity of that world, and being able to work on lots of different things in lots of different markets. I really, really enjoy that. So I'll be doing that for some time. Obviously, the usual conference circuit. I think there's lots going on, and particularly in open banking and open finance. Payments obviously is my stalwart. But yeah, I think we're up to about 80 countries now that are live or developing open banking. So there's lots going on, so it'll keep me busy for a while.
It's a big market.
Yeah.
Well, Lauren, it's been fantastic speaking to you. But before you go, could you tell us, I don't know, one or three things about you that we just don't know?
Okay. Oh, well, I better keep this diplomatic.
Oh,
Well, I play the drums, so I'm
no,
pretty
okay.
good. Yeah, pretty good at playing the drums. So when there's, I try and shy away in the background. And where was I? Nordic FinTech Week, and there was a band at the conference, made up of like all payments professionals or like FinTech professionals, and they were trying to get me up to play the drums. So yeah, I'm a drummer. although I don't get as much time to practice as I would like. I secretly would love to be a sommelier. I think in another life, forget the Prime Minister or, Member of
Brilliant.
Parliament, I'm just going to sit wine all day. That's like my dream job. Either that or a dart player, because they basically get to like play darts and drink beer all day, which I also think is a fantastic job. So,
What would your name be? You've got obviously Luke the Nuke. What would
oh,
you be?
Indiana Jones.
Ah,
Obviously,
superb.
come
Thanks
on.
for it. Absolutely great with
Bully,
arrows.
bully, straight in the bully. And I am extremely good at Sudoku.
Fiendish level. Yeah. Super fiendish.
Super fiendish. And like I try and and finish them as quickly as possible, so I put like a little timer on
What's your best time
for a week.
for a super fiendish?
I think what was it? I think it was like 4 minutes and something.
Holy smoke. Okay.
But it wasn't particularly easy one. Sometimes it takes me like days and I have to go back to it and then I get really annoyed at myself that it's taken me so long.
Sudoku fan?
I like Sudoku. I like the other one that where you've
Killer.
got the the one with the squares and they've got numbers and
Numbers,
scissors.
yeah.
He
Like
says, I
Skibble
love
Rider.
that
You
one.
do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see
It's
that.
my favourite.
I think there's going to be a little Icon Sudoku tournament.
No,
Sounds
it's not
good.
very competitive.
Well, we do have some musicians in the and some singers. So, there's
Okay.
guitarists and there's
Oh,
a few
band.
singers in there. Yeah, we could put the band
Take
back
it on the
together.
road.
That'd be superb.
Yeah, a global payments band.
Yeah, it'd be like
You want
Formula
to
One when they used to get the Formula One drivers would do that within
that?
payments.
Excellent, Lauren. Thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning.
And the way you've steered away from criticising any governments or any of your previous colleagues, politics is definitely in the future for you. So we're looking forward to seeing that.
I'm not sure if that's a compliment, Darren, but I'll take it as one.
I'll be your
No,
bad
thanks, guys.
carrot.
It's been a pleasure. Loved it.
Lovely to see you.